Checking on the Arts is made possible by the Memphis Symphony Orchestra and by Memphis College of Art. There may be no one who needs less introduction to a public radio audience than my guest today, Michael Pollan. He is the author of The Omnivore's Dilemma, Cooked is the new book, and he has joined me today, and it's good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Darryl. Good to be here.
You are going to be actually doing an event with our friends, the booksellers at Laurelwood. It's an off-site event at Crosstown Arts, which they have done several events there. And I encourage people to go to the booksellers and get a book, because that's how you'll get a line ticket. That's this evening at 6. And you're actually going to be at Nutt Auditorium in Oxford tomorrow evening with an event for Square Books. So,
co-sponsored by the Southern Foodways Alliance.
That's a great group, too. Cooked. You have been talking to us about food, telling us about what we should eat, what we shouldn't eat, why we should eat these things, but you haven't really talked about cooking because you didn't really cook until recently. So tell us about the genesis of this book.
Yeah, I cooked in a kind of thoughtless way. I mean, we cook dinner more nights probably than not, but I hadn't really considered cooking as part of the food chain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been on this project really for 15 years of following the food chain, figuring out where our food comes from, what's happening down on the farm, which I covered in Omnivore's Dilemma.
Right.
And then I leapt ahead and looked at nutrition and what happens at the body end of the food chain.
Right.
What happens when we eat this stuff? What are the links between diet and disease? And I realized along the way that the middle of the food chain, where the stuff coming off the farms gets processed or cooked, turned into meals, had a huge influence both on the farms, the kind of agriculture we have, but also on our health.
Mm-hmm.
And I discovered that, you know, when you're trying to figure out how to eat healthy, we all obsess about nutrients, good and bad. Should we be avoiding carbs or eating more protein or gluten or, you know, sugar,
right.
whatever. That this actually doesn't explain very much. And that the best predictor of a healthy diet was whether it was cooked by a human being or a big corporation. And if you're eating food cooked by a human, preferably someone who cares about you and your welfare, you're going to be eating well, whatever you eat. And that it is our outsourcing of food to big corporations, fast food especially, that is driving a lot of our health problems. And it's driving the industrialization of our agriculture.
Right.
Because those companies want to buy lots of cheap stuff, you know, from monoculture farms, which is really where all the problems of agriculture begin. So I realized at this point that cooking was perhaps the most important link in the food chain, and that I needed to look at it to both understand agriculture and get a grip on our health.
I think it's very interesting the way that you approached this, because you took the alchemist's idea of the four elements and progressively went through those elements, adding some complexity each time. Tell us how this is arranged.
Yeah, well, what I like to do in my work is get back to basics,
mm-hmm.
kind of find the origin of whatever I'm writing about, whether it's architecture or gardening or agriculture. And in food, I realized that in cooking, you could reduce all the kinds of cooking, and we have so many different kinds across so many different cultures, to four basic transformations. One is fire. And that's the most obvious one.
Sure.
And I talk about barbecue in that section. And then there's water, which is cooking in pots over fire, but a very different kind of cooking that gives you braises and stews and soups and is a major innovation in cooking. Air is where I look at baking,
because that's
how we put air into porridge, basically. And then earth, the last of the elements and the last of the transformations, is where I look at fermentation. This is, you know, in a way, the most miraculous cooking of all, that you can cook things, transform them without any heat whatsoever, strictly by the action of microbes, bacteria and fungi. And so I tried to master each of those fundamental transformations by apprenticing myself to a great pit master, or a couple actually, and to great bakers
mm-hmm.
and great mm-hmm. home cooks, and tried to figure out what's really at the heart and soul of these amazing transformations of nature into culture, or the raw into the cooked.
One of the things that I think is very interesting is that you take a sort of an anthropological point of view, in that you can argue very convincingly that when we started cooking is when we started becoming more human.
Yeah.
That we were able to essentially, and you said this very well, we outsourced our digestion to the fire.
To the fire. Yeah, this turns out to be a tremendous watershed moment in the evolution of from primates, from the kind of primates we were, into human beings. And it happens, it looks like, about 2 million years ago. And that's when we figured out that if you put food on a fire and cooked it, that you transformed it in such a way that it made it much easier to digest, much more flavorful, and much safer, because you're killing disease microbes. And so this is a huge breakthrough for us. And basically what happens is, when you do cook food, some of the digestive process, the breakdown, happens outside the body, mm-hmm. which means you have to spend less energy. And so that our digestive system is simpler and shorter, say, than another kind of primates. We also don't have to spend as much time chewing. Primates our size spend, this is amazing, spend half their waking hours chewing. It's very hard to get a lot done if you're spending 6 hours a day chewing. So cooking gave us this all this extra energy that other animals don't have access to. And this is what allows our brains to get a lot bigger. By body weight, and because brains use a lot of energy.
Right, right.
Your brain is 2% of your weight, but it's 20% of your energy consumption. So you need cooked food in order to support a big brain. And at that's the moment where our brains got big and our guts shrank. Now I think we're going in the opposite direction at the moment.
It seems like it, yeah.
but it was a big deal for us, and that puts us on the path. But also cooking created the meal. Because before cooking, when everyone was just kind of gathering food as they found it, you ate on the run and on the go.
By yourself,
exactly. Mm-hmm. Again, we're starting to do that again, which mm-hmm. is really weird. Mm-hmm. 46% of our meals are now eaten alone in this country. But basically, once you start cooking food, meat especially, over a fire, it's a cooperative endeavor. Somebody's got to, you know, take care of the fire. Someone's got to cut the meat. Somebody has to watch it. And then you tend to eat together.
Right.
And then you need all these rules, basically, to govern this process. Otherwise, you're going to have the biggest, greediest, hungriest person steal all the meat. So suddenly you need all these manners, really, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. which are the basis of civilization. It all begins around that cook fire.
It's fascinating stuff. We're talking with Michael Pollan. His new book is Cooked. It is just out in paperback, and he will be at an off-site event for the booksellers at Laurelwood tonight at Crosstown Arts. I think there's going to be some barbecue involved there.
Yeah, there's going to be a barbecue starting at 5, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then tomorrow evening, he's going to be at Nutt Auditorium on the Ole Miss campus with an event for Square Books. One of the things that I think is very interesting is that as you go through this process from fire to then cooking in a pot and then bread and then fermenting, what we add is the aid of other organisms.
Yeah.
Which I think is very interesting. I mean, if you're cooking a haunch of venison over a fire, it's really just you and the fire.
Yeah.
You get to bread, you have to have yeast, and you get to fermentation, you've got a whole host of other organisms.
You need a whole ecosystem, basically.
Yeah.
Actually, a well-baked loaf of bread, too, you need that community of organisms. It's not just
yeast. Doing sourdough
bread.
Exactly.
Which is how, you know, it started. The invention of bread, which we think happens about 6,000 years ago in Egypt, was also a momentous change. It's a technology, basically, for rendering grass seeds, that's what wheat is,
sure.
Digestible and delicious. And, you know, when I was working on bread, a food scientist I interviewed said something really that stuck with me. He said, you know, if I gave you a bag of flour, even whole grain flour and water, you could not live on that very long mm-hmm. if you're making porridges
sure.
or paste or whatever. But if you take that same flour and water and turn it into bread, you can live indefinitely.
Hmm.
So what happens to make that flour so much more nutritious? Well, the sourdough culture, which is a mix of yeasts and bacteria, start transforming the grass seeds, the flour, breaking down the carbohydrates, which are these long chain molecules that are hard to digest. Same with the proteins, breaking them down into amino acids and sugars, unlocking all the nutrients that are locked up in a grass seed, and then when you bake it. This interesting thing happens. I mean, if you're cooking in a pot over fire, you can get things to the boiling point. That's as hot as you can get them.
Right.
But in a loaf of bread, the bread itself becomes a pressure cooker. And so all those air pockets inside that are created by the yeast, mm-hmm. you know, exhaling their carbon dioxide, those get really steamy. And the temperature can get up to 300-400 degrees inside the loaf of bread, which thoroughly cooks the carbohydrates, makes all those starches delicious, and they start to break down and become delicious and digestible. So baking as a way to transform flour into something much more nutritious was a huge breakthrough. And that's why you had this situation where for most of European history, about 50% of the calories in the human diet was simply bread.
Sure.
But it wasn't white bread.
Right.
You couldn't live on that.
And then in the fourth section, you go into the fermentation arts, which is, I sometimes think people don't realize how much of what we consume comes from that cheese, beer, wine, all of those things, and of course, the various preserved food,
pickles, and sauerkraut, and kimchi, and every culture. You go around the world, and you'll find every culture has a fermented food that they eat a lot of. And that this is turns out to be, I mean, it began as a preservation strategy.
Sure.
Because when you do what is called a lactic acid fermentation, that's what sauerkraut is, you're basically breaking the sugars in the food down into lactic acid. That's what the microbes do. They're called lactobacillus. And lactic acid is a preservative.
Right.
So before you had refrigeration, this was the main way you could preserve vegetables and get from one harvest to the next, or preserve milk, which obviously is very perishable, except when you put it in this form of cheese. But it turns out that those fermentations produce a lot of new nutrients.
Mm-hmm.
You actually have vitamins that didn't exist before you fermented, like the vitamin B12, for example. Captain Cook kept his crews alive on these long voyages across the Pacific because, you know, they didn't have scurvy, but the reason was they brought sauerkraut, barrels
right.
of sauerkraut,
right.
and sauerkraut is what kept them alive. So I learned a lot from a man named Sander Katz, who actually lives in Tennessee and is a brilliant fermentation expert and practitioner, about how to do this. It's not that complicated to make sauerkraut or kimchi. Basically, it's amazing. It's a spontaneous fermentation. If you slice up a head of cabbage and salt it and bruise it a little bit with your hands, it will spontaneously begin to ferment because those lactobacillus are living on every leaf.
Right.
They're living on you, too.
Sure.
I mean, they're just waiting to ferment us. So the world is full of bacteria just waiting for their moment.
I like the way that you talk to Sander Katz, who's very well known for wild fermentation and a couple of other books, and he sort of refuses to be pinned down. He doesn't say, well, you do this and this and this. He says, well, it kind of happens this way.
Yeah, and he's pretty loose. And, you know, I think that's a kind of humility because these processes are really the bacteria are in charge.
Right.
And we can create a world that they like by a little bit of salt and getting rid of a lot of air, which they don't like that much. They're anaerobic. So he doesn't pretend to have the exact recipe. And you do it by feel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for example, I said, how much salt do I put on the cabbage? And he had this wonderful phrase, which I keep in mind, and it really works. He said, until it's salted, until it tastes salted, not salty. Now, we all have a slight different set point for, ooh, that's salty. And that turns out to be a perfect guideline.
This is fascinating stuff, and I'm curious as to where you go from here. You've explored the industrial food market. You've explored farms.
Yeah.
You've let us take a look at individual items of food and drink. Where do you go from cooked?
Yeah, well, you know, I have been working on some articles right now. I haven't launched on a new book yet. There's a couple ideas I have in mind. I really feel like I want to address this question that we hear all the time. How are we going to feed the world when we have 9 billion people?
Right.
Which is often used as a way to promote industrial agriculture because it's so productive. But it actually turns out the answer to that question is a lot more complex. That climate change really scrambles things, and that our goal in agriculture cannot simply be produce as much as you can, however you can do it, whether it's lots of fertilizer or chemicals. It's really going to be how do you make an agriculture that's resilient and can withstand the shocks that are coming with climate change, which we just learned from a IPCC report, UN report, that yields are going to go down with climate change.
Yeah.
We thought they'd go up because plants like carbon dioxide, but the uncertainty in the environment in both in temperature. Temperature is not, turns out, not very good for agriculture, raising temperatures. And the weather, the unpredictable weather, is going to make it very hard to grow food the way we've been growing it. We're going to need to diversify our farms. We're going to need to take more care of our soil, because soil is the great buffer, whether it's, you know, lots of rain or little rain. If you've got a healthy soil, it can withstand those variations. So I may do something in that area. And the other area I've been looking at that I'm really interested in is the things we ingest to change what goes on in our minds rather than our bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Everything from caffeine to psychedelic mushrooms to alcohol, and you know, we eat not just to keep ourselves alive, but to change our consciousness. And so I've always been interested in that. I wrote about that a little bit in Botany Desire,
right,
where I looked at cannabis. And what it has to teach us about the mind. So I'm doing some work in that area too. So we'll see.
Looking forward to it. Michael Pollan's new book is Cooked. It is just now out in paperback. He will be at an offsite event for the booksellers at Laurelwood at Crosstown Arts on North Cleveland there, across from the big Sears Crosstown building, this evening, beginning about 5-ish.
Yeah, if you want to eat, come early, and I'll be speaking a little later than that.
And I think you need to, if you want to get it signed, you have to go by the booksellers and get a copy of the book. Also tomorrow evening at Nutt Auditorium on the Old Miss campus as part of Square Books and the Southern Foodways Alliance series there. This has been a great treat. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Daryl, for having me.
Checking on the Arts is made possible by contributing listeners and by the Memphis Symphony Orchestra. The 2014-2015 First Tennessee Masterworks season will celebrate talented musicians and the Memphis community, featuring spectacular symphonic showpieces and guest artists like vocalist Storm Large and pianist John Kimura Parker. For information, 537-2525 or memphissymphony.org, and by Memphis College of Art, presenting Best in Class 2013-14 undergraduate artwork nominated by MCA faculty. The exhibition is on view through July 11th in the Rust Hall Main Gallery. There's more information online at mca.edu. Memphis College of Art, they make art work.